Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dee, and I'm an alcoholic. And I also feel that I'm going to get some sunburn here this morning. I get a few more freckles than I already have. And those of you who have heard me speak before and listen to my tapes know that I don't care too much for my freckles. So I may have a resentment against you forever because of these lights. But I have to also tell you that if my God were to appear to me this morning, and I don't know why she doesn't. I mean, after the kind of a night that I have had, I don't know why she doesn't. Some of you who slept at the hotel last night will know what I'm talking about. But if my God were to appear to me and ask me, is there any place else you would like to be at this moment, Dee, instead of here, I would say, no, this is fine. This is just wonderful. And the reason I refer to a woman God is because in the ministry I do, I work with priests and bishops all day long, and I love to let them know that there are more people than men in the world. But my own conviction of God, of a higher power, is a Father God. But I'm real grateful to be here, and want to thank the committee for inviting me. I want to thank Regina for meeting me at the airport so that I didn't become the orphan that I usually do become the minute I get off an airplane. I have very wonderful experiences at airports most weekends as I go through this country. And a couple of, well, I guess maybe years ago now, I arrived in some place. It was called Duluth in Minnesota. I'd never heard of it before, and I've never heard of it since. But there was this little place, and I arrived, and there was nobody there that looked like they were interested in me. And I went up to this man, and I said to him, are you looking for me? And he said, no, ma'am, I'm not. And so somebody told me that he probably thought I was picking up on him. But anyway, I always get these orphan feelings when I get off an airplane. And it isn't that I can't travel the whole earth by myself. It's just that I automatically am the queen of orphans. I do abandonment and isolation and loneliness and separateness and being afraid real easily. And I also want to let you know that whatever happens here this morning is the result of total personal powerlessness. Because I came here yesterday quite exhausted, and as those of you who shared this hotel with me last night know that the fire alarm started to go off at like somewhere between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, and I haven't slept since. And so I have turned this over to my higher power, and so what I'm doing today is I'm not running on automatic, I'm running on powerlessness. And I think that that's a real nice way to be. I feel very relaxed. I feel very released. I feel very surrendered. And I know that my God has the most wonderful sense of humor. My God has a wonderful sense of humor. What I came to let you know is that in sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you, that everything in my life was wonderful until I was two. And after that, it seemed like it all fell apart. And what happened in my case was that my little sister was born. And I came from Ireland, as you can tell by now. And when my little sister was born, for some reason, I will never know why people don't do this in life, but my parents didn't ask my permission. There are people in this world who don't ask my permission to do things. And I can never understand, because I have another disease besides my alcoholism, and it's called the disease of arrogance. And I assume that I'm supposed to be consulted, and I'm supposed to have a part and a sort of a casting vote in everything that happens in the universe, because I have a way of wanting to run the show. And I know that none of you, as I look at you from this vantage point, and none of you will identify with that, but I need to be honest since I come from California. So this, no offense to California, but anyhow, this little girl was born, and she was wonderful. She was beautiful. She had no freckles, and she didn't have red hair. And it seems that she was the epitome of beauty, and certainly it seemed that she was the center of my parents' attention. And they spent a long time adoring at her crib. It came to me, it felt to me. And they never once did say to me, we don't want you because she's here. But I felt different and separate and apart from and away from and not quite fitting or belonging. And then every year after that, my parents had another baby until we had five in our family, five children. And it just felt like I was always on the outside looking in. but always appeared like that I was doing it all and running the show and fixing things and doing things. And then when I got to be 8, my daddy went to work one day and he never came home because he was killed in an accident. A tree fell on top of him and it killed him outright. And I liked my daddy very much. And my greatest memory of that event was just a tremendous turnaround in that household. And there might be some of you here this morning who are new and who are not very long around Alcoholics Anonymous, and you might be wondering, well, what does this have to do with drinking? Now, my drinking career is the most boring story that I know, but my recovery is kind of exciting, and I don't have to go any place until 3 o'clock this afternoon. So just sit tight here now, and I'll get through this long life I've had. So anyway, we had these babies, and my daddy was dead, and I was the oldest, and what I can remember most was that my mommy took me into our spare room. When she wanted to tell us something really serious, she took us into the spare room. And she said, Bea, or actually my name is not Bea at all, I'm not that honest, my name is Bree Jean. And she said, Bree Jean, I want you to help me to raise these children. And so at 8 years of age, I decided that I needed to get rid of all the things that would say that I was a little girl. So I put away my doll, her name was Sheila, and I put it away, and I put away all my playthings and my toys, and I started into the business of growing up. And I would love to tell you that I had done that, but I haven't done so yet. And I started to ask my mom to raise these children. And she taught me how to clean and cook and babysit. And she was a school teacher also. And so she taught me how to do lots of school teachery kinds of things. And so I became very efficient on the outside at a very young age. And when I got into my teenage years, I did what most people do when they get to be teenagers. I started to think about what I would like to do for the rest of my life. And so what I decided to do was to become a saint. Now, I have to let you know that my feelings are always hurt when I see gentlemen like this standing up in front of an audience and reading. Stoney over here was reading out of chapter 5. And he was reading, we are not saints. We are, you know, striving to grow along spiritual lines. Well, in those years, and that's a long time ago, longer than I like to think, in those years, the only way that I knew to become a saint was to become a Catholic nun. And so I became a Catholic nun 39 years ago. And I'm still doing this nunny business. I may not look like I'm doing this nunny business, but I'm doing this nunny business. And I set into this. Now, I just need to let you know this one thing, that there might be a couple of you in the audience who have a resentment against people like me and Sister Regina here for one reason or another. And I don't know how Sister Regina feels exactly, but I want to let you know that in a group of recovering Catholics that you might have here, that I didn't do it to you, whatever that was. And I... Okay. Thank you. And I would venture to say that probably Sister Regina didn't do it to you either. And I say that because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took the responsibility of the entire Catholic Church on my shoulders, all the problems the popes had done and the priests and the bishops and the sisters, and I was responsible for everybody, and I was very upset with Alcoholics Anonymous and the Catholic Church and everything else. And what I need to let you know, quite frankly, and I have to tell you this just like it is that what I have discovered in my lifetime now in Alcoholics Anonymous is that, and I can say this because my sponsors are far away, and they can't hear me, is that there are assholes every place. I, what I discovered is that, through the years, is there one or two, I found one or two Baptist assholes and a few Lutheran assholes and at least one Jewish one. And I know this does not pertain to Wichita, Kansas, but in California, we have one or two assholes in Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I tell you that I get myself off the hook by telling you that I can't take responsibility for the Catholic Church. So anyway, I became this Catholic nun and got into this business and loved it. And I still do. I just love this life I have. And some of you recovering Catholics there will be wondering how I got my booze, and if you sit tight, I might tell you. But anyway, I was good at stuff when I became a sister. I was very clever. I just, something happened through the years, but I was very smart at one time. You wouldn't believe that, but I was. And so they sent me on to continue my studies. From Ireland, they sent me over to England. And they sent me to the University of London, and they told me they wanted me to be a top-notch teacher and to learn all there was to know about teaching kids of all ages. And so when I graduated from the University of London, I knew everything that there was to know about everything, not only teaching, but everything else too. And I was assigned to teach in a little school in the northeast corner of England. And I loved it. I loved children. I loved teaching. I loved all that, opening people's minds. It was just a wonderful adventure. I loved my work, and it seemed just grand. Except that something happened here between my ears, and I just know that none of you could have happened, this could have happened to you, but again, I have to be honest. What happened was that a little voice would start making itself heard to me. And the voice would become louder and louder and louder. And the voice would say, if only they would shape up, I would be better. If only I could get them to do things the way I wanted them to do it, I would be better inside. And that voice would grow loud and clear. And I started getting real uncomfortable and experiencing some of the apart from, separate, lonely, abandoned, orphaned feelings that I had when I was a little girl. Now, I didn't know anything about what was happening to me. I didn't know I was an alcoholic in the making, but I became very uncomfortable and my insides were churning most of the time. It seems to me, as I go around Alcoholics Anonymous, that many of us end up doing geographic. And so what happened to me was that I did a big geographic long, long, long before I took my first drink. And the geographic I took was from England at that time to Southern California. And I'd come home from school one day, and on our bulletin board there was a letter from our head bosses back in Ireland, our major superiors. And they had said, would any of you like to volunteer and go to Southern California? And I just knew that in California they were all waiting for me to impart upon them the gems of wisdom and knowledge that I had about education. I just knew that they were waiting for me. And so I signed up and I went to California. And I arrived in California in 1964 on the 16th of August. And in those days, we were wearing what I call the nunny habits, the nunny clothes. You know those clothes we used to wear? Well, if you don't know, maybe you saw pictures of people like us on the outside of Blue Nun wine. That awful stuff that you can only have when there's nothing else to drink. That's the kind of stuff that a lot of the parishioners used to give the nuns in our convent because they thought it was kind of holy. And I used to think, well, this doesn't count. You know, this stuff doesn't count. But anyway, we were dressed in these long black serge habits and starched up here, and we couldn't see our eyes, and you could only see our faces and our two hands. And I want to tell you, when I arrived in Los Angeles on August 16th, 1964, it was very, very hot. Very hot. But I knew it was going to be okay because my superiors at the time had wonderful taste. Before I left for California, they told me they were going to put me in charge. Now, there's nothing that an alcoholic in the making likes to hear more than they're going to be in charge. Because now I knew that I could get it all to work the way it was supposed to have worked right from day one. I could get things to shape up the way I wanted them to, and then I'd feel a lot better. And so I was starting off this wonderful school, and I was going to be the boss of all these nunny bunnies that were in the convent with me. And we were all there, and it was going to be fine. And everything went very well in California for about 5 days. And after 5 days, I was to meet somebody who was to be my arch enemy for many years afterwards, and he was known as the pastor. Now, for those of you who have an appreciation for our lifestyle, you know that it would have been kind of important that I would have gotten along with the pastor. But I didn't care for him at all, and he didn't care for me. Because he had made a mistake in his mind. He thought he knew everything, and I knew everything. I just knew I did, especially in my field of work. And we locked horns immediately. We had a personality clash right from the word go, and we got into a power struggle almost immediately. And I didn't know how we were going to do this. I didn't know how we were going to save face in front of those children we were trying to teach and in front of those nanny bunnies that I was the boss of and how I was going, and I didn't know what to do. And I was getting more and more uncomfortable and was getting hotter and hotter and hotter and we were fighting more and more and more and the kids were wilder and wilder and wilder and it was terrible. And one day this lady came to my office door. This is such a miracle for me. And she came to my office door and she said, "Sister," at that time we were having what we called the Santa Ana wind. You know that awful hot wind you get in Southern California? Gosh, it's so hot and it blows hard and the kids are crazy and everybody's all nervous and erratic. It's really terrible. And this lady came to my office and she said, "Would you like to have all the sisters come over to my house this evening and swim at our swimming pool?" And so we all got changed into our swimsuits and we put all those nunny bunnies into the big, long station wagon. We all had station wagons in those days because there were lots of nuns around. And we all got over there to her pool, and we swam and had a wonderful time. And after the swimming was over, she came to the side of the pool with a tray and a large pitcher and some glasses. And on the top of the glasses, there was salt. And I can just tell by looking at some of your faces, you might just have guessed what was in the pitcher. That's always interesting to me because sometimes I've given this talk in London and I tell them that and they go, "Meh," goes right over their heads. And because they don't do margaritas in London. And I question anybody's sobriety who could ever be, you know, here if they haven't had margaritas. And I just don't get that really well. But anyway, I was going to say a sip, but I didn't sip real well either. I gulped and I guzzled. And I took a large draft of this wonderful beverage she had in this glass with the salt on the top. And I thought, "Oh my goodness, you know, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. Where have I been all this time? Why do people go to work?" I mean, this is my answer. And then I knew as I sat there with this marvelous thing in front of me, I looked in adoration at this stuff that made me feel so good inside. I felt every trickle of it going to my toes. It was wonderful. And I thought, "I know what's wrong with me. I work too hard. I'm stressed. I'm pressured. This is a new culture for me. The method of education is entirely foreign to me. I've got to take the edge of my living somehow. And if I can get this on a regular basis, I'm going to be okay." And so I asked the lady for the recipe, and she gave me the recipe to take home to the convent, to the nunny bunnies. And so, and you know, those of you who have been around a long time know this, but I didn't know any of this. The denial is so built in, it's entrenched into our disease. And it was so much in me that I really thought, for sure, that the most wonderful, charitable thing for me to do on a regular basis was to whip up this little beverage for the sisters who worked so hard. I had no idea that I was whipping it up just for me. And I was 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I knew that nobody in that household liked margaritas except for me. Now, I don't know what Sister Regina's experience was with people who drank with her, but I want to let you know that people in my environment were very boring drinkers. They would always say, "Well, let's get the little glasses." They were always in for the little glasses. And I want to let you know that I was never interested in little glasses. I was always interested in large containers, like maybe a flower pot. That would be good. Anything that would hold a lot of whatever it was that I was drinking. And then they would sip. Now, I don't get sippers. I don't know how people sip alcohol. And they would leave it there, and then they'd sip again. And then they would leave it for maybe 15 minutes. And mine would be finished long gone, long since. And the awful thing that would happen would be that these ladies with whom I live would never finish their alcohol. And as far as I'm concerned, ladies and gentlemen, that's the only sin there is. I mean, you know. I'm glad some of you agree with me because I see this sin committed a lot in the world today. I see it committed on airplanes when I'm traveling every weekend, practically. And I see people ordering a drink, and God bless us, the stewardess comes along and says, "Well, you have," and they say, "No, thank you, that's it." And they don't finish. They do stuff out of their briefcases, and they don't finish it. I don't understand that. I truly don't. So what I used to have to do when these little gals were finished their sipping and they left it, I would have to go around with a pitcher afterwards and you know, take their leftovers and store it away for a rainy day because there are many rainy days in my environment. And it was awfully hard for me to procure my alcohol because I knew that alcoholics only drank in the morning, and of course I was not going to be an alcoholic or anything like that, and I had to pick my spots really, really well. One of the spots that I picked to drink was Mexico. It's one of my favorite countries in the whole world. I love it dearly. And there was this gentleman who owned a trailer in a little beach in Ensenada. It was called Estero Beach. And he came over one day and he told us that we could use his trailer anytime he wasn't using it. And he handed me the keys and he said, "Sister, this is the key of the front door, this is the key of the cabana, and this is the key of the liquor cabinet. Help yourself." And I said, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." I said that with all of my heart. And every time we got the opportunity on a Friday evening, I'd pack all the nunny bunnies into the station wagon and we'd say, "Let's go to Mexico." "Let's go to Mexico." You know, pretty soon 50% of the people in California will be Mexican. And we better learn how to speak Spanish. So we better get down there to Mexico. And we better get with the Mexican people and we better learn this stuff. But you know what is really in my head? But I didn't know. I thought I was going to learn Spanish every weekend and every holiday we got. And so we went muy pronto to Mexico as often as we could. And the sisters would say to me, "Do you think we should drink his booze?" And I would say, "Well, his feelings will be hurt." Now, it would never dawn on me that maybe, I would say, you know, maybe we shouldn't eat his cereal, but we would have to drink his booze. And so we went there as often as we could and as well as we could. And I was, then one day the pastor came over, bless his heart, and he said to me, incidentally, we've become wonderful friends in my sobriety. I don't know how that ever happens, but that does happen sometimes. And he said to me, "Is there anything that you people need or want?" And he always said that with his tongue in his cheek because he knew that I would always say something huge, grandiose, and extensive. And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, yes, we would like to have a bottle of tequila." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, you like that stuff?" And I said, "Oh, yes, we do." And I told him where we got our first little bit of tequila. And he went away there, and very quickly he came back with a bottle of tequila. And I think he got it where tequila is manufactured. And that's in the rectory where he lived. I think. I'm not sure. But I think so. And he said to me, "You know, we're having a little get-together with all the priests in the area next weekend." And he said, "I'd like to invite you people over if you want to come." And at that time in our church, and some of you, this is not information for any of you probably, but it's just interesting how these things happen. In our church at that time, there was a movement taking place. It was called Vatican II. And Vatican II, well, actually what happened was the Pope said, "Gosh, this church is real stuffy." Still is a bit stuffy. "This church is a bit stuffy. Let's open all the windows and let in some air, and let's renew ourselves and our hearts, and let's get a little bit more human, and get to understand what's at the heart of things and what we really, really meant by all of this stuff." That's what he was saying. But what I thought he was saying was that we could drink. That's what I thought he meant. And so we got to go out to people's homes and we got to do things that we didn't. I was almost going to say we got to take all our clothes off, but that wouldn't be appropriate here. But we got to, we got to change from the nunny clothes into these clothes, and it was just an interesting change for us, and we got to do things that we never got to do before. Like in my case, I got to go and visit my family when I became a nun. First, I hadn't seen my family in their home, in my home, for 18 years. It was 18 years before I got to go back and visit because I entered a semi-cloistered community. And so those kinds of things all relaxed. And so I thought part of the relaxation was that you could drink too. And so anyway, this priest invited us over there for drinks, and we went over for drinks and steaks, and oh, my goodness, and I saw all this liquor. I saw scotch and vodka and bourbon, and after dinner drank some wine, and I thought, oh, gosh, I've got to get friends with him. Somehow, he and I have got to learn to get along. In fact, what I did was, I did what it says in the 20 questions, like Susie was talking about last night. I sought lower companions. And so I stuck around him for a while, or in fact for all the years afterwards, until I could procure my alcohol on a regular basis, and I signed up for every committee, and I worked hard, and I figured that at the end of every job, you'd have to have a drink. Now, I want you to know this, and it's real irrelevant, but I never drank on the job because I knew if you did, you'd be caught. I never drank and drove because I knew if you did, you'd be caught. I tried to do what the big book says we can't do. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. And our big book tells us in chapter 3 But that's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, that somehow, someday, he or she will have the ability to control and enjoy their drinking. And this obsession, you know, it's tremendous. And the persistence of the illusion brings us to the gates of insanity or death. And the persistence of that illusion brought me to the gates of insanity. And I was in the gates of insanity and I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll pray more. I bet some of you prayed when you were drinking. And I thought, if I could pray more and teach other people to pray more, then I would be able to get a handle on this thing, and I won't be craving alcohol all the time, and I won't be making a fool out of myself when I can get alcohol. And because when I controlled it, I didn't enjoy it, and when I enjoyed it, I didn't control it. That's the way it worked for me. And so I decided to make a 30-day retreat up in the northern part of California, and on day 15 of the retreat, we had what was called a break day. And we didn't have to do all the retreat exercises, like we didn't have to do the 5 hours of prayer, and we didn't have to do the fasting. And the retreat people up there said to me, is there any place special you would like to visit, because you're from the South? And I said, yes, I would like to visit the Napa Valley. And some of you know that they make wine in the Napa Valley, and the Napa Valley is full of wineries, and we went to visit them because I thought that was being cultured. And so we set off that day, and I don't remember anything except that I had a tremendous hangover the next morning, and I was extraordinarily thirsty. And I woke up at the end of that 30-day experience, and I was very angry with God, because I had given what I thought at that time, what I thought I hadn't, but I thought I had given my entire self over to God. I had said I would not become married and have my own born children because I wanted to take care of the children of the world. And I thought I was doing wonderful things for God. And I had no problem having a relationship with God because God was God and I was Mrs. God and I was in charge. Totally. And that's just the way it was. And I would write lists and I would ask God, please, to shape up. And I asked God, please don't let me want to drink like this so much. Don't let me get into this craving. And 2 o'clock or 2:12 on my digital clock in my little room would say 2:12. And I'd wake up, and the only thing I wanted to do was have a drink. And I knew that if you were an alcoholic, you drank in the middle of the night, and I wasn't going to be an alcoholic. And I would try to pray more. And I would go down to our little chapel in the convent there, and I would beg God on my knees, and I'd say, God, please, please. And in the end, I got so angry. I used to go down to the chapel then in the middle of the night, and I used to give God the finger. Now, I'm sure that you've never done that. And I mean that because you look like you're real nice people. But I was very upset. I was very angry with God when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because God somehow had ditched out on me. I remember saying to a friend of mine, why has God deserted me? Why has he left me out? Why has he deserted me? And all of the time I was trying to perform and trying to be out there and trying to be in charge, and I did all kinds of external things, like I went to Australia and I did all kinds of work in Australia, and I went to Central America and I started a place in Central America, and dying to drink more than to do anything else in the whole world, just really out there in the front line. Now, I don't know where you were when you knew that you were dying. I know where Sister Regina was because she told me yesterday. If I were to start here and go all around this room, and if I were to ask you to describe for me, like Bill W. does in the chapter where his story is, where he describes on page 8 in that very little paragraph where he says that no words could describe the loneliness and the bitter morass of self-pity that he found himself in when he knew that alcohol was on all sides of him, and that he was surrounded by this tremendous obsession, the phenomenon of craving, and that it had become his master, and it had become like quicksand that outstretched on all sides of him, and he was dying. And if I were to say to each of you, how did you die? You would have different responses. Where were you when you died? Some of you would tell me that you were at home, you were in jail, you were in the hospital, you were on the side of the road, You were waking up out of a coma. You were arguing with your wife or your husband. You saw your child crying. You know, you would be telling me a variety of instances where you arrived at your moment. The moment of clarity, we call it in the program. And I want to share with you that I was in a very sheltered environment called a convent. I was living with beautiful people who were peaceful, prayerful, and kind. And I was dying all by myself. And I didn't have anybody that I knew at that moment that I could tell that I was dying. I didn't know any other live alcoholics. And I get to meet people like Sister Jean and people like you, and I think, well, where were you all when I was drinking? We could have had a ball together. And I was standing there in our living room, and I happened to pick up this book, this little book. It's a book that's written for sisters. It's called Sisters Today. And on the very back page, there was an ad. And the ad said, "Sister, are you concerned about your drinking? If so, please call this number, collect." Now, I thought of, out of the 140,000 sisters probably that there would be in the United States, that I was so unique and so terminally unique that I was probably the only sister in the United States that would have had a problem with alcohol. So when I read this little ad, I knew there must be at least one other person. And what I've learned about people like Sister Regina and myself is that statistically, according to the statistics, 15% of people like us are allegedly alcoholics. And the sad part about that is that less than 1% of us is getting any kind of help. And probably the reason for that is that being a woman, it's sad enough to be an alcoholic, but being a woman like we're women in this lifestyle, it's really a no-no, folks, I'll tell you that. You know, it's not real kosher to be a drunk nun, you know? It doesn't seem to fit or anything. It's just, you know, they don't get it. They like to have a little celebration occasionally, but they don't get it when all you want to do is drink. They don't just go rah-rah. We've always wanted you to be an alcoholic. That's just not what happens in our lifestyle at all. Like I'm sure it doesn't happen in your lifestyle either. Anyway, I made this phone call. I want to get real emotional because what I discovered was that the person to whom I spoke, I found this out yesterday, on the phone over those miles, the person to whom I spoke was the same person who was Sister Regina's counselor when she was in recovery. And I talked to this woman, and I told her lies because I wasn't capable of telling the truth. And I told her that I was changing jobs. Now, that was true. I was moving from being a school principal into the job I have today, which is a very high executive job in the diocese. And I'm taking care of all the other nunny bunnies in the diocese, over 500 or 600 of them. And I said to this gal on the phone, I said, "I'm very concerned because I'm going to be working with a lot with sisters, other sisters and priests, and I'm very concerned about their drinking. And I don't know how to work with people who have drinking problems." And she listened, and she was wonderful, and she was patient, and she told me about recovery hospitals like this hospital was. And they were just starting that recovery hospital for priests and sisters back in Boston, Massachusetts. And she said that, all that she sent me literature and told me about AA, and I was just about to hang up the phone because now I knew if I read what you're supposed to do, that I would learn how to control and enjoy my drinking. And at that moment, this person said to me, she said, "Sister, would you like to tell me a little bit about your own drinking?" Now, I would never know how somebody from Massachusetts who never saw me before would end up asking me a question like that. And then she went on to say something that I think is miraculous. She said, "Because I can hear pain in your voice." Over those telephone wires, over those miles, somehow this woman could hear the pain in my voice. And at that moment in time, I got the grace of God to break down and cry. And I cried into the phone to this voice, and I told her that I didn't know who to tell or where to go or what to do. And she said to me, "Maybe you could go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Oh, I could never go to Alcoholics Anonymous because everybody knows me And, well, I didn't tell her, but I alluded to the fact that I was kind of important. You know what I mean? And she told me what none of us understand. She told me that if I met anybody I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous, that they would be there for the same reason as I was there. And she said to me, and Regina will appreciate this because she knows this woman very well, she says that with all the loving concern that I have for another human being, I'm asking you to do something about your drinking. And I was to find out yesterday afternoon that Regina and myself had encountered the same woman. Isn't that wonderful? What a wonderful serendipity. What I want to say here is that the God of my understanding is always showing off to me. He's always showing off how he works, all his power, and what he can do. And it was a beautiful moment when we discovered this. Anyway, she did send me on literature, and her conversation never left my mind. Like Susie talked about last night, once you get a little taste of anything, you can't drink in comfort the same way. So I betook myself to Alcoholics Anonymous in Whittier shortly thereafter, which was quite a little distance from where I lived, because I didn't want anyone to know who I was, and I was still school principal, but I was moving into this job, and I was in so many committees that nobody paid any attention to the fact that I was going to meetings. So at that time, we were wearing a kind of a modified nunny habit. So I changed from my nunny clothes into regular clothes, and I put on a whole bunch of eye makeup, and I went down to Serenity Hall in Whittier, and Serenity Hall was a little club, like about half the size of this stage area here, and it was dark and gloomy and dismal and smoky. And I went in there at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, and I just thought I must have gone to hell. There were little old men there shuffling around. There was one woman who left finally, and there were, you know, just drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And there was one gentleman at the podium, and he was sharing his experience, strength, and hope with us. And this man was fascinating to me. He was using words that I used to punish the eighth graders for writing on the bathroom walls. He was using a word that I know you wouldn't have here, but they say sometimes in California it begins with sh. And then he graduated into another word that starts with th. And what was fascinating to me, one of my majors when I graduated was the English language, and what was fascinating to me was that he could use this th word in sentences. And he could use the fur word in different parts of speech. He could use it as a noun, a verb, an adverb, a preposition, and an adjective. He could even use it with ED on the end. And sometimes he would use it with the word mother in front of it. And I took a look at him and I thought, and this is going to be my spiritual leader for the rest of my life. And so I got in my car to go home, and at the very end we said the Lord's Prayer and just said, keep coming back. And I just thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do about all this. And I got in my car and it was raining and I didn't want to be there and I was crying. I was crying hard. And I looked in the rearview mirror, and this stuff I put in my eyes was rolling down my face. And I said the sh word and the f word all the way home. The convent. And when Regina and I were talking yesterday, she told me that her counselor wouldn't let her out of the hospital until she could say bullshit. So my only problem now is that sometimes I say it in the most inappropriate places. The bishop and I were talking about this problem in case we have in our diocese as a priest. And I said to him, well, you know, Bishop, the problem is he's just an asshole. And he just went like this. And a big smile came over and said, you're right. Good. And then we were at a larger meeting, and he said to the group, you know, there's one thing about Sister B, she always says it like it is. That was real polite in comparison. However, What I want to tell you was that I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be part of that outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there are some of you in this room this morning that when you walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, you knew that you were home. And the people in AA, there are some people who say this, they know they're home. It's different from just home. They're home. They're cushions in a kind of a home. I didn't feel home at all. And they were saying strange things at meetings. I went reluctantly, but they were saying strange things. And one thing they were saying was, don't drink. I got sober in December, and I didn't think that you could do Christmas in a convent if you didn't drink. Because Christmas was one of the few legal times we had for drinking, when nobody would be counting or watching or paying any attention. And so I look forward to Christmas and every other feast, and especially in the United States of America, since there's so many holidays here. And then St. Patrick's Day, which would last for 6 to 8 weeks, you know, all those big, long feasts. I always gave up alcohol for Lent, and St. Patrick's Day would be coming in there someplace. So you have to celebrate at least 10 or 12 days prior and after, you know, so it always takes you off the hook. But, boy, I didn't want not to drink. And they were saying, don't drink. I happened to tell this lady that I was talking to one day at a meeting, well, I won't drink today, but I will be drinking for Christmas. And she said, oh, B, we don't do Christmas until December 25th. Well, how about that? This was just December the 11th. She said, we just do one day at a time. That was just like a big revelation to me. And then they were saying, don't drink, go to meetings. And as I said, you know, I have this other problem. It's called arrogance. And this arrogance, unfortunately, comes from the fact that I think I thought, and I think sometimes that I know stuff. And I've in my bottom drawer, embarrassingly to tell you, that I have pieces of paper that say that I'm very qualified, academically very qualified. And so I have this handle in my head that says, you know, you don't need meetings. What could meetings ever tell you that you don't already know? You have this handle on God, for crying out loud, you know what to do. And so I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't think there was anything that they could tell me that I didn't know. And then they said, read the book. Now, I didn't care for the way the book was written very well because the English was not well done, I thought. And so what I did was I took it down to the beach and I corrected it. I fixed up all the sentences and I just fixed them so that they could be a little bit more readable than they are. I still have that edition for any of you who are interested in it. I brought it to Serenity Hall in Whittier and I told them about it then. And I told them that the syntax offended my sensibilities as an English major from the University of London, and they just said, keep coming back, Bea. And, I didn't want to do this stuff. And then they said, get a sponsor. Well, I don't know about any of you, but I had a terrible problem with trust. I didn't trust women or men or cats, dogs, fish or snakes or scorpions or anything. And they were telling me I would have to tell my stuff to other people. And so I couldn't do that because I didn't trust anybody. And what I did was, when they kept on harping on the sponsorship, it was real important, what I did was I would interview ladies and I would hire them temporarily and then I would fire them. And then, you know, I would just have to get another one because they weren't doing the things that I wanted, saying the things I wanted to hear. And then they were telling me to work the steps. That was very offensive to me, I want you to know, because see, I thought I'd work the steps. I thought I'd turn my will and my life over to the care of a God. I wear a ring on my finger that says on the inside, my God and my all, which is supposed to mean that at one time in my life I actually did this. I gave my entire being over to the care of God. I didn't have any idea how to do that until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was doing that. You see, what happened to me was I had a tremendous knowledge, a head knowledge of God. I had no inner affective knowledge of God. I was never able to get from my head to my heart. I had never had the experience of God until I met people like you. And what I need to let you know is that for some reason, God and I, just together, could never, ever, ever keep me sober. And the big fallacy that people like me have, and Regina and I were discussing this yesterday, is that somehow we think that we can be different. And we're not different. So one day I was in Serenity Hall crying. I did a lot of crying for my first year and a half to 2 years. So if you're still hurting between 2 years and three, hang in there because I was dying. Still at 3 years, I was still unsurrendered. I don't recommend this to you at all to do it this way. There's a much easier way to do it than this. It's called surrender. But if you come from the north of Ireland like I do,
And the graffiti that you write on the walls as a kid is "No surrender." And you come to a program and they tell you all you have to do be a surrender. You don't catch on real easy. You know, you don't know how to do this. So you hang on and you fight it with everything you've got. And so I was crying in Serenity Hall again. In fact, they used to call me the crying nun. And this little old man came up to me and he said, "You know, Bea, you're always in pain. You're always hurting. You're never happy. And this program is supposed to help us to be happy, joyous, and free." And I said, "Well, you know, you could have fooled me, because I don't feel happy, joyous, and free. I haven't had a drink, but I don't like it. I don't like sponsorship. I don't like the book. I don't like the way it's written. I don't like the people. And you people all seem to have it put together." And they had that thing that I call it. You know, that it. Now, here I go. The lady last night who was sharing, Susie, she said she took inventory of speakers. I take inventory of all of Alcoholics Anonymous, so Susie needn't worry about, you know, taking inventory. I do it all the time. But this is the inventory I take. I take, like, the first kind of brand of AA is what I called, that I was exposed to, was what I called low-life AA. Now, I know you wouldn't know what that is here, but low-life AA is when people come into AA and all they're looking for is a partner in life, really. They're not drinking, but they want a relationship. And so they hang around and they do a lot of 13-stepping and they do relationships, or, as my sponsor says, the difference between relationships and shacking up, he's not sure, but however. Then there's the other brand of AA, which I call the ho-hum AA. You know, well, now what? So what else is new? I've heard how it works 1,000 times, so what else is new? How long have I got to listen to this to the end of my life? And, you know, it's boring. AA gets boring. That's the second brand. And then the third brand is what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for. And I stay with the people who offer me this. It's called what I call classy AA. Classy AA. Well, this man in Serenity Hall in Whittier offered me just a wee glimpse of classy AA. And he said to me, "You know, Bea, this might work for you. Why didn't you go home and kneel on your knees and ask God to give you the willingness to change your attitude?" Now, with all of the pieces of paper in my bottom drawer and all of the exposure I had to workshops and lectures and seminars and universities and whatever I did, I had never heard anybody say that to me. Now, it isn't to say that they didn't say it, but I hadn't heard it. And so I was in such pain that I knelt in my room in my convent home and I said to God in a most awkward fashion, "God, could I please get some willingness to do whatever this is thing that I'm supposed to do?" And being as dramatic as I like to be, and as histrionic as I like to be, I would love to tell you that my God appeared to me, and there's a burning bush, and angels singing in the sky, and a rainbow, and God spoke. And I'm here to tell you that none of that happened to me. But I want you to know that if I ever, ever, ever get stuck on the program, if I'm what I call in between surrenders in AA, and I kneel on my knees and I ask God to give me the willingness to change my attitude, God always gives me the willingness to change my attitude. So I know for sure that it's a prayer that's always answered. And the second thing I know about that is that God's very stingy with willingness. Real stingy. I mean, like, as in, he only does willingness for Sunday, April 16. He doesn't do tomorrow. He doesn't do Monday yet. He just gives me enough to get me through Sunday. And so when I prayed for the willingness, I started to get a little bit more comfortable to do the things that were being asked of me to do. And for this lady, what that meant was following this blessed program of Alcoholics Anonymous exactly as it was designed, exactly as it is in the book, and in the 12 and 12, and like the people who have kept the steps and the traditions all the years, how they've handed that down to us. Not a la Sister B. This terminal uniqueness and arrogance that I had told me that there was a separate, different way that I might be able to work this program. And what I need you to know is that I got to understand that I had to work this program exactly as it was designed. And that, for me, was a whole and is a whole wonderful, wonderful journey. And that, for me, is an understanding and an experience of the good things that my God has always wanted for me. And the good things that my God has always wanted for me are couched in there, inside of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because inside of all the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I discovered is that there are at least 84 promises. And that includes the 12 promises that we refer to on a regular basis on page 83 and 84. And what was suggested to me was that I would start looking at this program and observing this program and working this program like I had a whole new pair of eyes. And one of my sponsors suggested that I would read page 62 like this. That I would take a look at the number of times that self is mentioned on page 62. And to my knowledge, self or selfishness is mentioned 13 times on page 62. At the bottom paragraph on page 62, it was suggested to me that I should read it like this. Because if I don't, I'll miss the point. It says, B. This is the how and the why of it. You have to quit playing God because it doesn't work. And hereafter, in this drama of life, God is going to be your director. He is the principal and you are his agent. He is the father and you are his child. And B, most good ideas are simple. In fact, they're so simple that you might almost miss them. But this concept that God is the new director of you, this concept is the new and triumphant arch through which you are going to pass to freedom. And on the top of page 63 it says, B, when you sincerely take this position, all sorts of remarkable things are going to follow. And then it goes on to list the remarkable things. As far as I'm concerned, the most remarkable thing that's listed on page 63, and incidentally there are 13 promises there, which I'm sure you've discovered many, many times, but the most remarkable of them is that more and more, less and less, first of all, that B will become interested in herself. That's a miracle. Because my basic MO is to be totally interested in and absorbed in myself. Selfishness and self-centeredness and the bondage of self is my problem. And so when I can become less and less interested in myself and my own little plans and designs, and I can become more and more interested in you and what I can contribute in life, that's a miracle. And that's a wonderful promise that I have seen happen through taking step three. And it promises me that I will be able to feel new power flowing in and that I will enjoy peace of mind. I will enjoy peace of mind even though the alarm goes off in the hotel room where I'm staying and I'm spending the night with the men who are here to do some bowling and who are in various stages of underwear at 2 o'clock in the morning on the floor. And by the grace of God, I get to meet two wonderful ladies next door to me who are on the program. And that I don't have to concern myself whether or not I get enough sleep because God's going to take care of me. Because what is promised to me is that he will provide for me everything that I need if I stay close to him and if I perform his work well. It's real simple. And what I found out was that all of these wonders are inside of the steps. Like if I do step four thoroughly, like it's suggested that I do, that I will be able to match calamity. My whole life was calamity. I'd be able to match that with serenity. That I would be able to ask God to remove my fear. I love that fear prayer in page 68. And this is the way I say it. You know, there's a little thing there, just a little sentence. It's hardly visible in the book. And it talks about fear. And it says, we ask God to remove our fear and ask us what he would have us be. And at once, we commence to outgrow fear. And so I say to my Father, I'm scared. I'm really afraid. Would you please remove my fear and tell me what you'd like me to be when I grow up? That's all. And when I do that, I start outgrowing fear. At that moment, it gets less. Now, it doesn't go away. It just is removed. You see, when God removes, he doesn't disappear. He just removes it. I can see it, but it doesn't affect my life. And what I discovered through step five, that there are 10 promises on page 75. You know, the wonderful one was that we can look the world in the eye. People like us who are so embarrassed and so ashamed and so hunched over and so, you know, separate and so, we can look the world in the eye. People like us can do that. And that we can actually literally feel our fears fall from us. And that if we can walk on the broad highway hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, we can do that as a result of step five. When I was privileged to take step six and seven, and when I was able to become willing and say the prayer on page 76 to have God remove my defects of character, I had the most powerful spiritual awakening I've ever had before that time or since. And this is what happened. I knelt on my knees and I said, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad." And at that moment, for the first time in my life, my God appeared to me. Not physically, but in my psychic sense, inside of me. My God was a father God. I'd grown up without a daddy, and I needed a father so much. And he was big, and he was exactly like the big book describes, all-embracing, never exclusive, all-inclusive, roomy, broad, you know, it was just wonderful. And my God was standing there laughing with a great smile and said, "Bea, are you sure? Are you sure that you're willing to just become you for me? Are you sure that you don't have to be perfect for me anymore?" And I said, "I'm sure, Father." At that moment in my life, I knew that I was God's kid for the very first time. Now, I had heard about that before. I had taught other people that. I used to tell people, you know, when I would give retreats, I used to say, you know, your God cares for you so much that he has branded your name on the palm of his hand. I used to tell people things like that, but I didn't think that God had carved my name on the palm of his hand because I was a little holly hobby orphan, you know, just scrunched in a corner with freckles and red hair and separate and different. I used to tell people, your God cares about you so much and loves you so much that he loves you and he knows everything about you, that he would store up your tears and he would put them in a little bottle. And every once in a while he takes out a little bottle. This is the image of God I used to give to other people. I'd say, these are Mary's tears, or these are Regina's tears, or these are John's tears. And I gave other people a sense of the preciousness of God's love for them, but I could never experience it myself. And through this God-given blessed program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to experience the preciousness that I was to God. That I was God's little orphan kid, floating around there like a splinter in the center of endlessness. And that my God loved me very much. And it was okay for me to have freckles and red hair. It was okay for me to be arrogant and self-absorbed and have a temper and be ambitious and be jealous and always wanting the last word. It was okay that my God loved me anyhow, and I knew about the gift of God's grace for the first time. I'd given lectures on it. I'd written papers on it. I never got it until I took step seven. And then I experienced so wonderfully, and I continue to experience the freedoms and the promises as a result of steps eight and nine, when I get to know the new freedoms and the new happiness, the new freedom that I've experienced since I've come to you here. Imagine the new freedom that I felt yesterday when Regina and I shared, and I truly felt we will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Isn't that wonderful? And we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Wonderful promises. And we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And what I know is that these suddenlies come like a little spurt. It's not suddenly and then it's all over. I get suddenlies all the time. God's always doing things for me that I could never do for myself. In the Spanish language, it talks about muy pronto comprenderemos que Dios está haciendo por nosotros. That God will do for us. He will just build in there for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And folks, I want to tell you that as far as I'm concerned, these are not extravagant promises. They are being fulfilled among all of us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize if we work for them. And I get to maintain and know about these promises through step 10. When I continue to do my inventory and examine my life and know for sure that if I'm ever uncomfortable inside, that it can only be if I am selfish, absorbed in self again, dishonest when I'm telling you I'm fine when I'm really not, you know. I heard a fellow in Serenity Hall say one time, the only prayer he ever says is, "Dear God, please help me not to believe in my own bullshit." Honestly. Resentment, which we're told on page 66 will kill us. There's a death sentence there in the second paragraph on page 66 that if we stay in resentment, we'll die. Because the insanity of our disease will return and we will drink again, and for us to drink is to die. And even if we don't drink again, we'll die as a result of resentment. We cannot live a full life if we're resentful. We cannot live a full life if we're in control and if we're angry. We can't do that. And so I have to look at my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, and my fear. And I have to do exactly what the book says. I have to ask God to remove it, and I have to tell it to other people. I have to make amends, and I have to help other people. But the promise is, in step 10, get this for a girl from the north of Ireland, and we have ceased fighting everything and everyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. And my God will place me in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. He will place me in a position where I can look the world in the eye, I can stand tall, and I don't have to apologize for the room underneath my feet anymore. What a classy place to be. Embarrassingly enough, I used to teach prayer and meditation, like I mentioned, but I learned how to do prayer and meditation through people like you, and I was taught how to pray and meditate by being referred to pages 86 and 87, where it tells me clearly what I must do when I wake up. When I wake up, it tells me I think about the 24 hours ahead, and I consider my plans for the day. The book is so wise. It doesn't say you get into your plans, see, and do them all before you get out of bed. It says, consider, gentle, consider your plans for the day. And then ask God into my thinking process. Invite God to direct my thinking. And asking him to free me from the bondage of myself, basically. And from the wrong kinds of motives and from dishonesty. And the result of that is that what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of my mind. That what I get to understand through step 11 is that when I constantly do what I'm asked to do through the step, which is to remind myself that this is not my deal anymore, this is God's deal, that I'm not any longer running this show. So the book tells me at the bottom of page 87, I have to constantly remind myself of that, and I have to say many times each day, "Thy will be done." And a lady at our meeting says that we have to say, "Thy will be done, and I mean it." That's different. And the promise is that if I do that, that I'll be free from excitement, fear, anger, depression, all those things that I didn't want anyhow. And that I'll become much more efficient. And that I won't get so tired because I won't be burning up energy foolishly as I used to do when I was doing it to suit myself. That's the classiness of the program that I've been privileged to feel. What the program has told me in step 11 is that there are times that I might become agitated. And I know you never are, but what happens in California sometimes is that you go into the bank and there's always a line. And they're always training a new lady there when I go. That's called being agitated. Yesterday morning when I was getting here, when my luggage was going through the, you know, detector thing, they saw something in there, and they asked me if I had a gun or a knife. And I said, no, I didn't. So So they undid all my luggage, and I usually only take hand luggage when I'm coming for a short period of time, so that means I squish everything in really carefully so that I can get it all in there. So the lady took it all out, piece by piece. As she was doing this, my plane was being called, that it was the last call for me to get on my airplane. Now that's a cause for agitation. It was difficult for me to say to her, she was apologizing and she was very nice, and I said to her, you're only doing your job. And I didn't say, screw you. See, my sponsor Mary Ann says, all you have to do is behave. All you have to do is behave. And behave is just not a word, you know, just behave. It means everything. It means the steps, the book. Do everything appropriately. And so Mary Ann tells me regularly, behave. And so I have to behave in every place I find myself. I have to continue to do that, to work the steps, and to be an example of this program. Now, I have no idea how Step 12 works, but I know that as a result of doing Step 12, we get to experience 25 promises. They start on page 89 and they go on right through page 164. They're wonderful promises. But we won't be lonely anymore, and we get to watch people recover, and we get to see the light in their eyes, and what used to be terrible for us gets to be wonderful for us, and all that real goody stuff. I just love it. But I don't know how it works. I have no idea. I couldn't tell you at all how any of it works. And so I want to let you know that all I know is that it does. And there might be a couple of you in this audience today who are wondering if it does. And because I have a sense that maybe there is, I'm going to end with a story. And this story, I hope, won't offend anybody, but it's not intended to do that. And it's a story that happened, it was told over 2,000 years ago, about a man called John. And John was a cousin of a famous man who lived at that time, and his name was Jesus. And John had been misbehaving, and he had been sent into prison. Now, I don't know what exactly he did, but I guess he was doing bad stuff. At least they thought so. And he was in prison, and he was real lonely. And some of you might identify with that, being real lonely in prison. And some of his friends came to visit him. He was allowed a visit or so. And John was a real good follower of his cousin, this friend of his called Jesus. And he said to his friends, would you go back and ask Jesus, is he the one that we're looking for, or are we supposed to wait around and look for somebody else? None of this seems to be working out. And so his friends went back to Jesus and they said, John wants to know, are you the one we're looking for, or are we supposed to wait for somebody else? And Jesus says, what wonderful words for people like us. He says, listen, go back and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. The deaf can hear, the blind can see, and the crippled people can walk. And the poor ones, the powerless ones, have the good news spoken to them. And if you're here and you're wondering, is this what I'm looking for, or am I supposed to be looking for something else? I'm here to tell you that in the years that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have actually experienced my own deafness fall away sometimes, and I can hear. I've experienced my blindness fall from my eyes, and I can see sometimes. And as crippled as I was under the bondage of myself, with no self-esteem, no dignity, and no confidence, I can stand tall before you this morning and look you in the eye and love you. And I've experienced, through this blessed program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've experienced the good news of this blessed program and these steps and traditions. I have heard them spoken to me. For those of you who have been around this program for many years, who have kept the traditions, and who have worked the steps, I want to tell you thank you. because you've paved a road for me that when I could come along, that I would be able to experience life. I will always be indebted to you for that. And may God bless you, and thank you for having me here. I love you.